Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Fran Michelle, and I'm your host for today's show for September 14th, 2020, on KBOO Portland, your independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. Broadcasting at 90.7 FM in Portland, 104.3 FM in Corvallis, 91.9 FM in Hood River, and streaming everywhere at kboo.fm. Before we get to our show today, I want to remind you that you can be part of this amazing resource, broadcasting for over 50 years through pandemic and wildfires by joining, volunteering, or contributing by clicking on the red donate button in the upper right corner of the website at kboo.fm or by going to kboo.fm/give or by mailing an old-fashioned check through the old-fashioned and essential service of the United States Postal Service to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. We're not in the station to take your calls, so you can't give by phone, but you can still show your support by giving online. Plus, if you support KBOO now, before September 20th, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. You give $5, the station gets $10. You give $50, the station gets $100. You give $5,000, the station gets $10,000. You get the idea. Again, you can go now to kboo.fm/give, or you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon, 97214. Don't wait. Do it now. Make your contribution go farther. On today's Old Mole Variety Hour, we live up to our middle name, Variety. Bill Resnick interviews Portland Association of Teachers President Elizabeth Deal about the return to schools in this time of COVID. Desiree Helligers interviews Lisa Loving about her street journalism training for covering protests and more. Patricia Kullberg reads a review by book mole Larry Bolden of two historical novels by Marlo Benn, Passing Fancies and Relative Fortunes. And Desiree Helligers returns to talk with Barbara Ford about climate change and radical hope. You can find our shows archived on the KBOO website with posts of weekly shows and individual segments at our page on kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. While you're there, you can subscribe to the show, and we invite you to friend or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com if you have questions, comments, or suggestions. We turn now to Bill Resnick, talking with incoming union president Elizabeth Deal of the Portland Association of Teachers about how the heck kids are going back to school in a pandemic.
Hi, Elizabeth Deal. Welcome again to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Deal is the newly elected president of the Portland Association of Teachers. The Old Mole Show has interviewed Elizabeth when she taught at Portland's Madison High School. And she's also taught throughout the district, in fact, mostly at middle school. She taught English. Elizabeth was also, in every school, a union activist, became vice president of the union, and is now the president. Elizabeth Deal, the Portland schools are now in session, nearly all through online distant learning. That in so many important ways greatly differs from in-location group learning. we're going to discuss what this all means, especially for teachers, for teaching, and for critical, active, often group learning, much more difficult online than where kids are, in fact, interacting with one another and learning from another and having social activities with one another and talking about school. The unions become very important for helping the district and the teachers adjust to distance learning. First of all, Elizabeth, tell us about the letter of agreement between the Portland Public Schools and the union, and about the whole process of creating distant learning schools and structuring them so that the students, still very young people, most children, some as young as 6 years old or before, how to help them feel good about learning and good about the relationships with their teacher and with other children. It's hard to replicate that online.
Yeah, thanks for that question. So first of all, you're absolutely right. Distance learning is very different than in-person learning in lots of ways. And I think it's important to remember that we aren't doing distance learning because it's a better model for teachers or a better model for students. We're doing it because we need to protect public safety. I mean, it's been a really hard transition, I know, for families and students and certainly for educators. And one of the things that unions get to do is sit down with the district and talk about our working conditions moving forward, and things are just totally different in a distance learning environment. So some of the things we've talked about around our MOA, or Memorandum of Agreement, around working this fall, are acknowledging what it actually takes to run distance learning classrooms in a way that, like you said, that's engaging and motivating for students. I mean, it's just totally different. So one of the things we know is it takes a lot of time to create online lessons, that teachers aren't able to just use the lessons and projects and activities that we've used in physical classrooms. Things have to be totally rethought and then created into a totally different format. But we also know that a lot of teaching isn't just about delivering information. It's about making connections between the students and the educators, and also between students. And we know that takes a lot of time. And so what we've heard from educators is that it's just crucial to have the time to reach out to students and their families. Families are in a really different position right now in terms of having to be involved in their students' education. In terms of giving students feedback on their work, teachers can't just look over a student's shoulder and comment. You've got to do each one of those communications individually. And it's just been really important to educators to be able to have the time to do the things that can make distance learning personal and meaningful and motivating to every student.
In your discussion with the district, what are the particulars of gaining both the time and the structure and the developing the expectations for students? It'll just take time to acclimate them to this whole new system and also to get to know one another. I suspect that the first couple of weeks really have to be spent to be able to sort of create relationships between the kids, among the kids, I mean, and getting them to feel good about being able to relate in that way. How is the union approaching those questions?
That's exactly right. Well, we know, especially in this pandemic and in this uprising across our country to address racial injustice, the heart of learning is about making connections, forming relationships, and understanding how what we learn in school applies to our real lives. And that has always been true, but it is true now more than ever. And so I'll say in Portland Public Schools, the first 2 weeks of school have been called the soft start, and the purpose of this time for every classroom has been to make sure that all of our students are accounted for and have the ability to log in and understand the systems, because like you said, it is all brand new to students and parents and educators, and it's a lot to get used to. So the soft start has been a time to emphasize those relationships. But we know that moving forward into like the regular academic year, relationships are still the most important thing, and making sure that learning is meaningful is still the most important thing. And we especially know that under distance learning, for most students, the things that motivate them in school aren't just receiving information, but it's all those interactions and the ability to work with other people and to look at other people's faces and reactions and gauge their own communication by how the course of a discussion goes. And everything is different in terms of that. So educators are finding incredible creative ways to engage students, to keep them interacting with one another, and to make learning relevant. And that is one of the things that is super important to educators in Portland that I hear from, is making sure they have the flexibility with curriculum to make sure that they are responsive to the kids that they have in their classes.
Yeah, that makes the union really important, doesn't it? Teachers talking to teachers and discussing their experiences and what they've tried and what works and how you relate to kids in this new environment. It seems to me that's crucial to the development of all the teaching staff in the school. And in fact, it can't be done from some bureaucratic center saying, get together whatever. You have to have all these relationships that the union has, right? Because you have steward systems, you have all sorts of people working together, thinking about the schools.
That's exactly right. And again, it's always been the case, but it is true now more than ever that understanding what works in classrooms, that understanding has to come from educators and students who are in those classrooms seeing how things work. So educator voice and decision making is crucial, and it's one of the foundational goals of our union or any union, is to make sure that the workers have power to make decisions about how to make the work go the way it's supposed to.
This is your Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio 90.7 FM Portland. The Old Mole explores the struggle, mostly by working people who are the great majority, to create an egalitarian, caring, democratic, sustainable society. I'm Bill Resnick, talking today to Elizabeth Teal, the next president, now sitting recently, the Portland Association of Teachers, or standing and walking and struggling. After 16 years of teaching, both in middle and high schools. So one thing I wanted to ask about, but we really don't have time, the schools have always provided a nutritious meal, and Portland Public Schools has tried hard, a nutritious meal to kids, many of them probably their most important meal of the day, with, of course, snacks in the morning for young kids and sometimes after-school programs. It's really important, it seems to me, that the schools do that. Is that working out well? What's your sense?
Yeah, well, starting in the spring and continuing to a much greater extent this fall, Portland Public Schools has been providing meals to students. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but they have been providing breakfast and lunch for students to pick up at school sites in numbers far greater than even what they typically serve to students when it's on site. So there's a huge need in the community, and the nutrition workers of Portland Public Schools have been out at site every day giving food to families to make sure that kids have nutritious breakfast and lunch and food for the weekend as well.
Yeah, the public schools are so important for, in fact, most working class families.
Yeah.
Elizabeth, some years ago we did an interview on an unprecedented, not just in Portland, but in the country, unprecedented, Portland's public schools union, the PPS union contract that gave teachers a great deal of room for team teaching, for collaboration, for developing more engaging curriculum, more enriching curriculum, for active learning, for students examining issues, developing solutions. That, in contrast to teaching often demanded by our business community, in quotes, and conservative legislators, that focused on improving taking tests and the test scores. In contrast, teachers want to educate kids to contribute them to them becoming active learners and not force them to become test-taking machines. I wonder what's happened after that contract that you won. It was really a heroic struggle to gain more control over teaching methods and the things kids read and experience. I wonder what's happened to that over the years, and what is the impact of the distance learning on some of those great advances?
First of all, it is absolutely the case, and no educator comes into the field of education in order to help students do better on tests. So much of what we know is important for the growth and development of children is not something that you can capture on a standardized test, and it never will be. And so it's the wrong measurement of what a successful school looks like, what a successful student looks like. And we know that standardized testing was designed to and continues to rank kids in a way that reproduces racial inequity, and it does harm. So, educators believe that real education is about empowering students, helping them to develop their strengths and to be motivated and inspired to be active participants in the world around them, as well as to be successful in the things that they endeavor to do. And so much of that does not show up in a test. So it is crucially important to educators that we have, yes, we need to make sure that students are learning the important skills that schools and educators are certainly equipped to teach them and support them with, but we need to be able to do so in a way that is relevant to our students, that's motivating to them, and that connects with the things that they find important and that, honestly, most adults find important in the world. And standardized tests just don't touch so much of what we know is most important.
Does the pandemic have an impact on forms of teaching?
It has, and actually, this is a really interesting question because there's been some really different things happening. So one thing that's happened during the pandemic is that many standardized tests have not been viable to do. So Oregon did not do state testing in the spring because students weren't in physical schools. And colleges in California, University of California colleges, stopped requiring the SAT and the ACT, not only because of the pandemic, but because acknowledging the role that they've played in racial discrimination in their admissions process. And so there is this movement to acknowledge that standardized tests right now are pretty hard to run, and the value of them is very much in question. And so there's this possibility of stepping away from that. And at the same time, there's a force moving in the opposite direction, which is, we're already learning online. Why not just standardize it, do it as pods, do it as modules? There's been a big push for many years from the high-tech industry to reduce learning to modules and things that you could sit in front of a screen and take in. And educators know that that's not what good education looks like. It is certainly not what the wealthy would choose for their own kids when you talk about computer-driven education or standardized education. So we're at this moment, I think, with the pandemic of choosing a path. And we've got to think about what our values are around public education and make sure that we are doing everything we can in this moment to push for the future that we want to have and that we envision and that we need for our students, and not allowing a corporate interest to take advantage of the chaos of this moment when everything is being reinvented.
Elizabeth Theo, before we end the interview, I want to say that in preparing for this interview, in thinking about it, I came to realize, and I'm sure many parents came to realize, that teaching is a great skill. It's not something that people can just pick up and do. And the teachers who really master the art of teaching, it's an art and a skill, they are a great societal treasure because they can bring forth a new generation of great teachers that contribute to the development of thinking people, thinking and caring people. Elizabeth, you get the last word, and then I'll sign off.
Thanks, Bill. I'll just say educators want so badly to be back in physical spaces with students and cannot wait until it is safe to do so. And so collectively, we need to do everything we can to get to the point where the pandemic is not stopping us from being together safely. But it seems like that's a long way off. Teachers are going to incredible lengths right now to make sure that students have the best possible experience in the conditions that we're facing.
Elizabeth Teal, president of the Portland Association of Teachers, thanks for talking to us and in working to build a school system that Portland students, teachers, parents, all of us deserve and need. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Bill. You too.
A little of Alice Cooper's School's Out, and before that, Bill Resnick and Elizabeth Thiel discussing the reopening of Portland Public Schools. I'm Fran Michelle, and you are listening to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered, non-commercial, listener-sponsored, full-strength community radio for Portland, Oregon, the Pacific Northwest, and the world. Support this station by clicking on the red donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage at kboo.fm or by going to kboo.fm/give. Because KBOO is keeping its staff and volunteers safe from COVID, no one's in the station to take your phone call, but you can show your support by giving online. Support KBOO now before September 20th, and your donation up to $10,000 will be doubled through matching funds from the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Later on today's show, we'll hear a review from bookmole Larry Bolden and an interview about climate crisis and radical hope with activist Barbara Ford. We turn now to Desiree Heligers talking with Lisa Loving about journalism and public participation.
Guest today is Lisa Loving. Lisa is a journalist, writer, and media educator. She was a longtime news reporter with the Scanner News Group out of Portland and Seattle and with KBOO Radio. Lisa is the author of the book Street Journalists, Understand and Report the News in Your Community, and she's presented on the book and her workshop on editorial and op-ed writing, How to Write Your Rant, at bookstores, universities, and community centers across the country. Thanks for joining me today, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me.
First off, it seems like, you know, street journalists have played a really important role in covering the protests in Portland, and I know that you've worked actually with some of those street journalists who are covering the protests. So can you talk a little bit about why you feel so strongly about teaching everyday people about how to cover the news?
Desiree, one thing that a lot of people don't realize right now is that over the past 20 years, our major media platforms have basically collapsed. And it's been a slow motion train crash, definitely. And there's a lot of statistics about how many fewer reporters we have on the ground now compared to 10 years ago. Media outlets, large and small, have been hit by this. And there's all kinds of reasons and analysis about how and why that has happened, starting with, you know, the internet, Facebook stealing the thunder away from newspapers, just to take one super duper specific example. And I'm going to probably end up talking about Facebook a lot because it's been a real wrecking ball to societies and communities all around the world. And they're beginning to be held accountable, but we'll see what happens with that. When you realize how many fewer reporters there are, even just to take one example, the Oregonian, our major legacy media outlet is the Oregonian, which is a more than 150-year-old newspaper, but it has not been a daily in quite a few years. They stopped distributing daily newspapers to Eastern Oregon actually a long time ago. The same thing's happening with radio stations and television stations. I've seen what's happened more recently with the COVID pandemic. The pandemic actually wiped out a major source of advertising revenue for all kinds of media, like, you know, entertainment venues, bars, has had an unbelievable impact. Now there's even fewer paid reporters that are backed by an institution on the ground here in our town, Portland. And then all of a sudden, Portland becomes ground zero for the President of the United States re-election campaign. President Donald Trump, election's just a few months away. He's having worse. He actually had really bad poll numbers. And then all of a sudden, these protests in Portland, these protests around the country around Black Lives Matter and police accountability, both. Protests have been happening actually all over the country. I want to say Louisville, Kentucky has also had nightly protests, but you don't see as much news about Louisville and these other places as you do Portland.
Portland's had a pretty contentious relationship in some ways with elements of the federal government for quite a long time, giving us the name Little Beirut, and the fight, I think, over the Joint Terrorism Task Force has put us in the crosshairs of the FBI. And
I think that that's part of the reason why the president focused on Portland, also because it is so small. He could just stub us out like an old cigarette, for real. But Portland's tradition of civil unrest and protest of all kinds, Portland does have a long history of that, longer than a lot of other places, actually, considering what a young city we are, too. Anyway, even as for once, you know, what has been known for years as the whitest city in America finally had a huge movement in support of African and African-American people, with probably at a moment in our history when there are fewer journalists available to cover that, fewer than there have been since the beginning of the city. I want to pivot back to who the journalists are themselves on the street. Like for myself, I've been working to mentor and train emerging journalists, teenagers, retirees, people of all kinds from all over the world for years. And it always has struck me how a lot of people believe that a journalist has to have like a college degree and there has to be some kind of special badge or something that gives someone the right to collect information and then share it with the public. And so now with the Black Lives Matter movement, we have seen in Portland and nationally as well, like a whole generation of people who just literally took their phones out into the streets and started recording what was going on between police and protesters. A lot of people start out just by live streaming because it's the simplest thing you can do. There's issues there. It's not really safe for the people around you if you record their faces, because the police and, as you were mentioning, the federal government monitor that too. One of the traditions in Portland is that law enforcement goes and arrests people days after the fact based on recordings. So who is in downtown Portland right now reporting on these issues? Like what I've seen is one of these interesting people is a preschool teacher. I've seen her video on MSNBC. I can't remember her name. And so we've seen some people putting their work out there, having their work picked up by national outlets, and then their name becomes known. There's a lot of complications with that that I don't want to get into too much, because someone could write a whole book about that. So the way I see the people in the street right now is, you know, and the Portland police's view is that they can't tell who a journalist is and from everyday people. So they're not going to give anyone the right not to be shot. All of the projectiles that they've shot. I mean, I think there's a fundamental legal decision there that's probably going to be argued in court for many, many, many years to come. But the long and the short of it is everyone's got the right to be a journalist. And there's got to be a way that we can get information about what's going on around us, even if the Oregonian only has three reporters. More than 100 nights of protest, consecutive nights, the Oregonian was cycling all of their journalists through that night shift. And I mean, I even remember when they had their food reporter actually went out to cover the protests for a night.
The more that journalists were embattled and assaulted, the more important it became for other folks to be out there live streaming and making that violence visible.
It's totally shocking. I mean, I've never seen police in the United States just beat reporters before. So the other class that I've been working on and presenting is in combination with KBOO Community Radio with my incredible colleague, Jenka Soderberg there. And it's a class on protest reporting. We've offered it, I believe, two or three times now. More than 100 people have gone through this class. We've had people enroll in it from all over the country. I have a new publisher. I've got a new book coming out, Vinyl Publishing in New York. And my publisher there has asked me to write a follow-up book, a sequel to Street Journalist. And they're really interested in a book about watchdog reporting. You know, Street Journalist is basically an invitation for people to go out in the street and gather information and share it. But watchdog reporting as a book, the idea of that is to give people more ideas and more tools to focus on the parts of the municipality, the society, that they're seeing that is not getting covered. Oh my God, Desiree, there are so many stories that are not being covered right now. It makes my head spin.
So Lisa, can you tell us a little bit about how people can get in touch with you and how they can find out about workshops that are going on, how they can plug into your work?
I've got a website. It's called streetjournalist.com. And you can contact me through there mostly. And I hate to say this, a lot of my stuff is on Facebook, which is a vortex of disinformation and platform that we should all be massively challenging right now. So on Facebook, I'm Media for the People, the number four, Media for the People. And Lisa Loving, L-I-S-A-L-O-V-I-N-G. I'm also on Twitter. I'm at Lisa Loving on Twitter. And on Instagram too, L Loving. But if you just shout me out on social media, we can absolutely touch base. But my favorite thing is when people have a big idea, and because we need innovation, and it's not going to come out of an existing newsroom. I'll tell you that right now.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for joining me today. My guest today has been Lisa Loving, who's a journalist, writer, and media educator. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thanks again for having me.
This has been Desiree Helgers for the Omo Variety Hour.
Seem to know that Mother Nature rules over the earth. And a lot of people don't want to know what this life is really worth. Instead of hiding in your corners, living a world of fantasy.
No discipline for one another,
hey. They wanna break forces
from the team.
This world is on fire. That was a bit of a song from Winston Flagg Smith, and I recommend the video, linked from our page at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Before that, we heard Lisa Loving talking with Desiree Helgers about street journalism. Desiree will be back later in the show with Barbara Ford to talk about radical hope in the face of climate chaos. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, the station that can get you radioactive. And that's a good thing. You can find out about volunteer opportunities by going to kboo.fm/getinvolvedvolunteer. And you can support the station, the shows, and the other volunteers by going to kboo.fm/give with your credit or debit card or banking information at hand. Do it now, because we have matching funds. Double your money. Double your radioactivism. Again, in these pandemic times, we cannot take your phone calls because we are not in the station, but you can show your support by giving online. Support KBOO now, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000 until September 20th, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or you can mail your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. We turn now to Patricia Kullberg reading a double review by book mole Larry Bolden of two novels by Marlo Ben.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kullberg reading today for book mole Larry Bolden. Recently, it was suggested to me that I buy two novels as companion pieces, Relative Fortunes and Passing Fancies, both written by Marlo Ben. They are indeed companion novels, and so I am recommending them to you as a pair. While in one sense they are light reading, in fact there is much substance to each of the novels. They take place in 1920s Manhattan. You should read Relative Fortunes first, and I suggest that you then move directly to Passing Fancies. The heroine is an elegant and fiercely intelligent character by the name of Julia Kidd. She has returned from Europe to Manhattan in order to collect her inheritance, which has been held in trust and meted out in increments by her much older half-brother, Philip. She is to gain control of the inheritance when she turns 25, and there is much made in the novel about the ridiculous laws that make it difficult for women to control their own money without the need of a male, husband, father, relative, to advise and control. For some reason, and Julia really does not understand what it is, Philip has decided to contest the will that his father made, leaving a small fortune for Julia, who is born to his second wife. Philip does not need the money, since he already has a much more considerable fortune, and yet he makes it clear he intends to challenge the interpretation of the will and to deny Julia her portion. Since she has no residence in New York, she is invited to stay at Philip's brownstone, and the repartee between the siblings is witty, intelligent, and captivating. The two discuss events of the day, the foibles of so-called high society and women's suffrage. Julia insists she is not political at all, and she wants only to launch her own private press with the emphasis on the beauty of the books more than the content. While Julia claims not to be political, when it comes to the treatment of women, she cannot and will not be quiet. When a famous suffragist, Naomi Rankine, dies suddenly, and it is deemed a suicide, Julia is more than skeptical and suggests to Philip that she may have been murdered. This thread in the novel makes it read like a mystery, and the repartee between siblings reminds me a lot of Dashiell Hammett's delightful Thin Man. The reader comes to discover that Philip is, in fact, very sympathetic to the suffrage movement and to the emancipation of women. He is also, if somewhat secretly, really enchanted by his young half-sibling. He proposes to her that if she can prove that Naomi's death was, in fact, a murder, he will drop his challenge of his father's will. Clearly, author Ben is more interested in the history of the period than in simply writing a good mystery. The combination of mystery, comedy, and serious social political content makes this a delightful read. Without revealing the twists and turns of the mystery in the first volume, let me turn to the second, Passing Fancies. The political content of this novel is obviously the controlling theme. Julia's desires to launch her publishing company lead her into what is now called the Harlem Renaissance, described on the novel's jacket as a, quote, literary movement where notions of race, sexuality, and power are slippery and identities can be deceptively fluid, end quote. This second novel, published in 2020, is remarkably relevant to current issues. Julia becomes acquainted with a singer, Eva Pruitt, who has written a book that is rumored to reveal, quote, lurid details about the Harlem nightlife, end quote. A nightclub owner is furious about the book because he thinks his character is the inspiration for it. When he is murdered, and the manuscript and Pruitt are nowhere to be found, Julia Kidd steps in to solve the mystery. During a police raid on the nightclub, Eva is treated very badly and would have been treated worse if Julia and her brother Philip had not been present. Julia's friend, Christophine, is informed of the raid. Quote, Christophine was angry but not shocked to hear of Eva's treatment. The police she knew were not white lady police. It was a horrid term, crawling with implications. It suggested there was no such thing as what Julia had always referred to as simply the police. Didn't everyone, or rather didn't every white person of her acquaintance? The definition she considered standard and universal, a helpful force for public safety and well-being, was apparently only one version of a widely varying reality. Even more unsettling to consider, Eva's experience might be the more common and Julia's the more rare. The notion upended something foundational. End quote. Eva is an African-American woman who has passed for white, but once she is outed, she is treated as simply another black troublemaker. I hope I have not given away much of the intricate plots of either of these novels, and yet said enough to encourage readers. The greater distance I got from my own reading, and the more I heard from reader friends I passed them on to, the more I felt it important to recommend them to Old Mole readers. I have been talking about a set of novels by Marlo Benn, Relative Fortunes and Passing Fancies. This is Patricia Kullberg, reading for Larry Bolden and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Janelle Monáe and Big Boy doing some of Tightrope, and before that, a review of two novels about the tightrope of gender and race. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, reminding you that you can support KBOO by giving online at kboo.fm/give. And if you do it today, your donation will be matched, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or you can mail your contributions to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Finally today, we hear again from Desiree Hellegers, this time talking with climate activist Barbara Ford about radical hope.
I'm speaking also today with Barbara Ford, who's a retired clinical social worker. Barbara was a student of and collaborator with the groundbreaking eco-psychologist Joanna Macy. She's a longtime climate justice activist and artivist who has volunteered for the past 5 years with 350PDX to help create art-based actions and resilience training for climate justice. Thank you for joining me today, Barbara. So we're taping on Friday, September 11th, and 10% of the state is facing the threat of possible evacuation as wildfires burn out of control. And many people are really struggling in the face of evidence that climate change is progressing more quickly than was predicted in some studies that were once deemed exaggerated or hyperbolic. So can you talk a little bit about this concept of radical hope?
First of all, I want to say that I do not equate hope with optimism. There are two different things. And hope is sort of a trigger word for a lot of people right now because there's so much, right, that's just going on right now. It's not just about the fires. It's also about, it's like layers of trauma that we are experiencing. And various members of our community are experiencing it, have been experiencing it longer or more intensively than others.
Yeah, and clearly this is in the midst of the pandemic, and it's exacerbating the respiratory effects that make people vulnerable to the pandemic, and then there's the economic fallout from the pandemic.
Yes, and it really is. This moment is really illustrating the intersectionality of all the issues that housing justice is connected to climate justice, is connected to food justice, is connected to fascism, is connected to racial justice, is connected. This is one of the moments where there's an uncovering of things that have always existed that are becoming more visible for people to get, oh, we're all learning on our own levels and seeing new eyes what the situation actually has been for a lot of people, but is coming to affect more and more. And this moment of I'm sitting here sealed in my house, which I'm lucky to have a house to be sealed in, surrounded by poison air, and also have been contending with all the other issues that, you know, we just talked about. And also, we also have personal issues. My mother just died, and so I'm contending with that as well in my body and my heart. So, and everybody has their own personal processes. So what I want to say about this idea of active hope or radical hope, whatever word you want to do, is that it really isn't about some idea that you hold on to that everything is going to be okay. That's not what it is. It really is about a kind of a stance that you take in the face of all these things of how do you want to be in the world? Like, no matter what's happening, because so much is still going to yet to happen, who will I be in the world and where do I find meaning? I want to give a little quote from my favorite quote on hope from the writer Rebecca Solnit. She says, "Hope is not a lottery ticket you can sit on the sofa and clutch feeling lucky. It is an axe you break down doors with in an emergency. Hope should shove you out the door because it will take everything you have to steer the future away from endless war, from the annihilation of the earth's treasures and the grinding down of the poor and marginal. To hope is to give yourself to the future, and that commitment to the future is what makes the present inhabitable." That one quote is something that I hold on to of how do we make the present inhabitable, and how do we stay present without turning away and without shutting down? Because that would be a very common and natural response to what's happening. And that doesn't mean we don't stop and take care of ourselves and get away from it some, but there is something about who do we want to be? Do we want to be somebody who will offer themselves in one way or another as best we're able to serve justice or to serve the world? Or do we want to be somebody who just gives up?
Certainly Rebecca Solnit, particularly in a book, A Paradise Built in Hell, has written extensively about some of the worst aspects of late climate change. So she's certainly coming at it from a reality-based perspective. And I really appreciate the connection that you made earlier to housing justice, especially given that so many houseless people in Portland have not only been breathing tear gas night after night from the police riots, but now are also breathing forest ash night after night, and all of that in the midst of the pandemic, in which people with respiratory problems are particularly vulnerable.
Right. And also just want to note that the source of police oppression, the source of climate change, the source of fascism, et cetera, all come from the same source, which is that power over consciousness, which is part of the colonial mindset that this country was founded upon. One of the things that I appreciate about the work that I've been trying to do and what Joanna Macy was teaching was everything needs to be done. So you might as well do what your heart calls you to do. Not everybody can be on the front lines. Not everybody can be a journalist. There needs to be the people who will be the people who will feed the people. There needs to be the people who will take care of the children. We need the artists also, and the musicians, et cetera, to kind of hold our hearts and remind us what we're fighting for and what we love. There's so many ways to participate in the healing of the world. If you believe in an interconnected world, then you have to understand that we all bring particular gifts that serve, sort of like a permaculture garden. Each creature in the garden has a particular skill set or particular role. And if everybody was a pollinator, it wouldn't work, right? So there's a part about my version of hope that's like finding out what my role is in this moment. And it may be that people feel called to the front lines, but they may feel called to other things as well. Or they may really have limited personal resources and their job is to just sort of keep themselves going or keep their family going in the midst of all this.
So, you know, I'm really struck by the connections that you're making to colonialism and the extent to which colonialism is really rooted in a kind of ideology of rapacious structural violence, militarized violence, and really an ideology of kind of objectification and disposability, in which both like ecocide and genocide are both justified. And I think it's interesting that we're talking on 9/11, and we've been hearing about the massive numbers of people who've been displaced by the U.S. wars, but there's no public dialogue about the fact that the U.S. military is the largest single institutional generator of carbon emissions globally. So I just wanted to put that out there, but I think you're saying basically don't allow yourself to be overwhelmed by feeling like you have to do everything.
Yeah, because A, you can't, and B, that's not how it works in an interconnected world, because we need it all. You know, we need people who are drawn to veterans' rights to do their work and, you know, to do that work. And we need people who are, I mean, I can name any number of things that are, you know, absolutely necessary, immigration rights, et cetera, or just healing a piece of land, for example, or, you know, supporting sovereign land sovereignty. Part of the experience of this radical hope is having folks understand that they can choose to dedicate their hearts and discern, like, what is mine to do in this moment? And that doesn't mean that I'm saying that everybody has to do something really, really important right now. Some of us are just in a place of just, you know, survival, you know, roles and providing more support. And that means that could mean any number of things, or providing some version of mentoring or some version of just listening and care. It's an ongoing journey. Nobody usually does one thing for their whole life.
It seems like it's worth noting, too, that it's often the labor that's provided by women in the form of childcare or care for the elderly that is often seen as secondary at best. But now more than ever, we really need people to be dedicated to the care of people who are being left behind, even while we address the structural roots of their disposability.
Right.
Barbara, thank you so much for making the time to talk to me. I've been talking with Barbara Ford, who is a retired clinical social worker who has volunteered for the past 5 years with 350 PDX. Barbara, can you tell people how they can learn more about your work?
Sure. I have a website. It's Barbara Ford, B-A-R-B-A-R-A, Ford.net. And you'll see information there about workshops that I do, writing, art, things like that. I'm also on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay, Barbara, thank you so much. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was Toots and the Maytals with Pressure Drop. Toots Hibbert died this past week, but the message lives on. The pressure will drop, the storm will come in, and the arc of the universe bends toward justice. Before that, we heard Desiree Helgers talking with Barbara Ford about radical hope in the face of the climate crisis. You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and I've been your host today. Thanks to Desiree Helgers and Barbara Ford, and to Desiree's earlier guest, Lisa Loving, for their conversation about people's journalism. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Elizabeth Thiel for their discussion of the reopening of schools. And thanks to John Nilsson for editing. Thanks to Larry Bolden for his review of novels by Marlo Benn, and to Patricia Kullberg for reading and recording. And thanks to you for supporting KBOO.